Hello, I'm Basha Getkin.
Hi, I'm Kostya Gorobets. Welcome to Borderline Jurisprudence.
Today we have Andreas Hagioriou, member of the Human Rights and the International and European Law Committees of the Cyprus Bar Association and special teaching staff at the Frederick University Cyprus. Andreas, welcome.
Hello, it's really nice to be here. Congratulations on your podcast. Its ambit is really within my interests, and I'm really glad to be a part of it and to see it out there. So,
Great to have you here. And with this episode, we introduce a new section in our podcast where we have conversation with early career scholars who do research in philosophy of international law. So, Andreas, you have recently defended your doctoral thesis that is called The Oxford Jurisprudence Circle, A Lost Legacy on Customary Law. Would you tell us a little more about it, and why is it relevant for jurisprudence of international law?
Let me tell you a story of how I came to write this thesis. When I first started my PhD in international law, I was looking, well, I knew what I wanted to say about certain aspects of international law, but my professor kept pushing and saying, you know, you have to find a platform, a theory to expand it, to communicate it to others. So I used Hart's theory of international law. And then he was like, yeah, great. That works great with your argument, but you have the problem that everyone else reads Hart differently than you. So you have to address that first. So it's like this pre-question you have to explicate to your audience before you can use Hart's theory. So that was the first problem. But the second problem was that I found out that my different supervisors were reading Hart differently in their own way without recognizing it among themselves. So that really got me to dive harder into Hart's theory and a lot into the historical context of what was around it. And I don't know, I guess I read this biography of Hart by this guy called Simpson, who was attending Oxford at the time. And then he said people from Oxford were only interested to explain or make themselves understood to people from Oxford. So that really got me wondering about the Oxford heritage and what was around at that time. Hmm. I hadn't really realized that it was this bubble, different from the rest of jurisprudence. I guess at the time you didn't really have an international scene. So and of course I was interested above all with the concept of customary law and primitive communities, which is the main themes of Hart's take on international law and the most controversial aspects of his theory. And looking into Oxford jurisprudence, I realized that they build a whole school of thought around the concept of customary law. I mean, this is what defined their school as a school against every other position out there. So that didn't really seem a coincidence that Hart would use these elements that his predecessors used in such a strong manner without there being a connection. What was interesting was that in reality, I found out that the works of Hart's predecessors, who were all building on the first occupier of the chair of jurisprudence, who was Sir Henry Maine, were more interesting, I would say, and more they had more potential than Hart's theory. But I made a conscious choice, instead of explicating them on their own ground, to present them through Hart, because Hart keeps a very dominant position in jurisprudence, and then showing a new perspective on his theory and convincing people that Hart never doubted the legality of international law seemed strategically a much more strong move and more beneficial move for international law within general jurisprudence than just bringing out these unknown theorists. I think the effect they had on Hart is more legitimizing.
Yeah, but before we dive into Hart deeply, why is it a lost legacy? Why do you call it this way?
Well, it's lost because I've been studying jurisprudence for all these years, and I haven't been studying international legal theory. I was studying jurisprudence, and I never really heard of them. And to be honest, before finding them, I was a little bit disappointed or fed up with jurisprudence because, as a student of jurisprudence of your first steps of specializing in it, you kind of get lost because there's not really a structure in the debates. Each philosopher uses his own dichotomies and his own strawmans to attack. And it's really hard to bring it all together. And at a certain point, all these lines kind of disappear. Tamana Hai, in his book, Realistic Theory of Law, calls it theories that gain identity vis-a-vis each other. And it's true. At a certain point, you run out of abstract and theoretical arguments without having anything being decided within a debate. So what I like about Main's legacy is that he brings this empirical dimension. The empirical data is what decides between competing theoretical perspectives. So that kind of structures the debate and makes it more real, touching about reality.
Yeah. But would you maybe outline who actually comprised this Oxford jurisprudence circle?
Oxford created the chair of jurisprudence because they really wanted to attract to Oxford Sir Henry Maine, who was this kind of like peculiar genius who would touch upon many interdisciplinary areas of law at a time when interdisciplinarity wasn't even a thing. So he tried to attack analytical jurisprudence on the concept that it was abstract, but at the same time, he was admiring it in the sense that he didn't want to throw it away. He said, we just need to combine it with a solid historical understanding of how law came to be. So he admired the analytical jurisprudence that Austin was envisioning, but he thought that you cannot achieve that without a solid historical understanding. All these assumptions about how law came to be, the sovereign that connected everyone. By looking into history, he kind of gave analytical jurisprudence an evolutionary spin. So law is not something static, it's an evolutionary phenomenon, it grows alongside society. And then his main contribution, I feel, to jurisprudence is that it says, yeah, if we try to understand law just by looking at how it exists right now in time, we will always be mistaken. So he has this analogy of how to understand a human being, you have to look back historically and evolutionarily to see how it developed as an organism. And this is the same about law. So beginning with history, you move into this evolutionary idea. And this connects to anthropology, sociology, philosophy of language. And yeah, I like how it expands the debate, but at the same time limits philosophizing. You've had like these theories who made a very compact kind of contribution, all centering around Maine's work. And at a certain point, it was completely erased from jurisprudential textbooks because it wasn't philosophical enough. At least that's what Tamana Hack claims in his book. He has like this chapter called Virtually Erased. And he tracks this conversation between theorists claiming that, you know, you shouldn't be including this school within your jurisprudence textbooks because it's not really philosophy. So I don't know. I feel that Hart kind of like utilized all their works to support one philosophical perspective or kind of like create a philosophical perspective around what they have been theorizing. But somehow after Hart, jurisprudence was completely detached from all the historical, interdisciplinary, and philosophy took, again, this privileged position and kind of like took over jurisprudence, which to a point where they kind of became identical.
So as you mentioned, your thesis is in many ways an attempt to give a proper intellectual and cultural context for reading Hart's concept of law, especially chapter 10. So what do you think have been the major misunderstandings about Hart's approach to international law that you seek to rebut?
I think this kind of a relation of the structure of international law with the structure of the communities of with primitive communities is the most critical source of misrepresentation in Hart. Because, I don't know, I guess within the context of Kelsen, for example, who called international law primitive law, I guess this was a misunderstanding that Hart should have anticipated and should have clarified more. But people seem to think that Hart's characterization of interrelation of international law with customary law and primitive communities seems to be evaluative. Like it somehow makes international law less law. But if you actually read Hart's theory from the beginning, and don't just read chapter 10, but read 10 through the context of what Hart said generally about primitive communities, you will see that that's where he starts talking about law. Law begins in primitive communities. And for someone who takes an evolutionary perspective, the first moment where you begin to talk about law is what defines you as a theorist. And this is what I came to trace in my book, that there are different schools of thought within positivism, and they're all defined by which point in history, in historical development, they start using the word law. So this was the focal point. Obviously, you can define schools of thought by taking their disagreement on different points, like what they say about interpretation, what they say about the function of courts. But I think, so using the idea of the genesis of law, like where do they start speaking of law, has been very underrated and underused, but it was what took over jurisprudence at the point between Austin and Hart. And this is what came to define Austinian positivism, realists, and Hartian positivism. But although these three schools, like these three positions, formed like these schools that still dominate jurisprudential thought, this fourth position of Main and the Oxford Circle, those who actually began this debate on the genesis of law, is completely forgotten. I feel that Hart is their bigger representative, but it's not as self-evident as it should be.
You underline this link that Hart makes between international law and primitive communities that many find so problematic. And yeah, I completely agree with you that this category, like primitive communities and primitive law, that Hart uses quite often, the concept of law was quite mysterious and also generated a lot of criticism. Yeah, because he thinks that international law is not really law. And I still encounter this assertion that Hart thought international law not to be law all the time. And I kind of want to ask, did you read chapter 10, like where he says the opposite? But how would you define this primitive legal order? Like, why is it a good analogy for international law, actually? Because I think it's especially international lawyers who get quite offended with this comparison or with this link.
Well, first, I would like to say that a theorist who says that international law employs the same structure as primitive communities does not necessarily mean that international law has no law if he comes from a legacy that made an identity out of arguing that primitive people have law, customary law. And this is exactly the case with the Oxford Circle. Of course, the biggest problem with No, the biggest problem that they had was that they were bringing out the necessity of theorizing about customary law and creating a theory of law that starts from there, but they themselves did not have the philosophical capacity to actually deliver that. And of course, this is where Hart comes in. So of course, we would have to explain it in Hartian terms, but you would be surprised how his terms actually trace through to this legacy. Having a word for law, like as a distinct category of rules, necessarily entails a kind of formalization. And this is what the rule of recognition does. But both Hart and the Oxford Circle speak of law even before that point. So what they have traced is that there is a category of norms within the whole customary regime that just spawns out of human interaction when just humans come together, that plays such an integral position in keeping this together that rightly deserves to be called law even before it is formalized, institutionalized, and even before it is comprehended. Hart makes reference to a sociologist that has employed the Oxford Circle methodology and perspective throughout his life, and his name is Bronislaw Malinowski. And basically, this was Malinowski's big contribution to jurisprudence. The point that where he goes and employs fieldwork to show how we can discern this category that will eventually be separated and identified as law with a separate word through the actions of the participants within society, the perspective that they take, how they justify them. So this was a big debate that he had with the realists, and where Carl Llewellyn responded to by also going into field work. At which point can we talk about law within a primitive community that does not even have a word for it? Both Llewellyn and Hobel on the one side and Malinowski argued that you can identify a category of legal norms even before you have like a separate word for it, but they both use different methodologies. In Llewellyn's position, you still have this semi-organization of the community taking a conscious decision to say this was a violation. In Malinowski, there's also this other category that coexists with this, and that's the category of norms that are definitely legal norms, and you can see that they're legal norms even though they have not been violated and they might not be violated, like that robustly accepted that I know that if it gets violated, it will garner the same response, but it just doesn't reach that point because even subconsciously they realize the integrity that the integral position that it holds within keeping society together. And looking at the primitive level, it becomes most obvious where the individual really relies on the community to be kept alive. We're talking, I mean, Malinowski traces this small community where even this, I mean, there are breaches of rules all the time, but there are certain rules, certain practices that if there is a breach, the whole community runs the risk of disaster. So we're talking about how you preserve food for the winter. Like even a small mistake in those practices can just make a whole community disappear in the winter. So obviously those kind of rules don't get violated very frequently, but if they get violated, a community might be wiped. So a methodology that always needs to have a violation first will always leave an integral point out. And I think this is also what Hart did. He employed kind of like this reactionary participant position to trace out what could be law before it even gets termed as that. And it wasn't just a theoretical exercise, it was actually responding to the point of his predecessors. And this is his main disagreement with the realists, that customary law is law even before it gets applied by courts. And because Hart employs the internal point of view, he has a very important tool on his tool belt, because he says this is how judges actually speak of law, even at the very, very first appearance of courts, that they're already applying pre-existing law. Because he employs the internal point of view, he cannot just come out and say, like the realist does, that, this is just, they're lying, or they're just pretending, or they're just mistaken. Hart is actually tied by that, and he says, if you want to take seriously what the participants do, this is a reality you have to come to grasps with. And this is where realism comes out as a deconstruction, because its main point to be asserted necessarily entails that what the judges do and say is mistaken. And committing to a theory that's like so radical in this sense, where I have to deny most of the way that participants talk within a legal system, the social kind of philosophy that I would be interested to support.
Yeah, so this links them to the current debate in international law as well, right? Especially about customary international law, when we have this idea, well, is it that the international court's formulation make them up, or does it exist before? But also the point that you identified earlier about this idea that there is certain set of rules in primitive communities that are so crucially important that, like, even the smallest minor violation can lead to a complete disaster. So is that also something that defined Hart's reading of international law? Because that seems how he kind of read the idea of international law, that this is a kind of set of basic coexistent rules.
With Hart, it's kind of like interesting because he really took a position, a strong position within this debate towards customary law, but he really did it with a view of explaining domestic legal systems. Now, what's interesting and problematic and probably another source of misunderstanding is that in reality, although he wanted to use his theory of customary law to explain legislation and domestic legal systems, his theory of customary law with his theory of legislation are not compatible. There is wrong kind of connection between the two, like there is something missing. I wasn't conscious to this, because if you choose to read Hart through the customary law perspective, then pulls everything into one perspective and only one perspective only. But as I was reading Lassie's biography of Hart, well, she says it explicitly. She said that within Hart's journals, she found that he consciously realized that his theory of customary rules and legislative rules does not fit together, but he was still convinced that his theory of customary rules was correct. It took me a while to come to grasp with, and this is where Gerald Postema helped me a lot, was actually to realize that although I mentioned this contradiction within Hart, and although I say that in this way because there is this contradiction and Hart recognized it, you cannot read the concept of law concisely, I still go and pretend as if I do that, when in reality, now I see that I don't. What I do is that I have a faithful reading of his perspective on customary law, but then my reading of his legislated rules necessarily has to be reconstructed, or else it does not give out a concise theory. Of course, Gerald Postema recognized this many years ago in his article on implicit law. And I completely piggyback on his analysis because I agree. So I think that starting with the Oxford Circle and reading Hart's customary low position through that really makes clear his perspective about the genesis of law and where we can start speaking about law and what the nature of law is. And then from there, it's easy to fill in the pieces using Postema's reconstruction. This is an important point. Most people have been trying to read Hart through his theory on domestic legal systems. And that means either ignoring his part of primitive communities or just reconstructing it. So, I mean, Dworkin explicitly said that for Hart, primitive communities don't have law because they don't have a rule of recognition. So from there, you see how in order to support a kind of Hartian reading of a legal system, as it has been dominantly labeled, you have to mischaracterize how Hart took a position in primitive communities and thus international law. So starting the other way around brings out very interesting results.
So we talked quite a bit about custom, and you mentioned the three schools of thought, the neo-Austenian command positivists, the realists, and then the Hartian positivists. So what are the lessons for customary international law from this rather jurisprudential approach? What can we deduce from it?
International law is interesting because it's an interesting case because it really garnered interest when this debate about customary law was already in really big trend, and the concept of customary law was really like heard and heard and heard. I mean, Professor Cardi traces it to Savigny, who is of course the historical school of law, not to Maine exactly because they're completely unknown today, but exactly because it was so heard at that time, it became the dominant trend in international law. So this is what most participants understand within international law. There is customary international law, but we don't really have a theory to explain it or even connect it to domestic legal systems. So it's really interesting how there's this really used concept within international law, like customary international law, customary international law, but there's not really a theory under it that really explains what it is. And you would think that exactly because it's so used, it would be so researched into. And of course you have that, but no one really tries to conceptualize customary law generally within the concept of law in general. So what is its position? And then a lot of people treat it also as something static. Well, for the evolutionary perspective, it's just the beginning. It gives like this foundation. It's the part of the customary structure that is the beginning of law. And then through that, you have different agencies and techniques of building on it. And this is what Maine traced out. I mean, you have, first of all, the function of the courts themselves by interpreting and reinterpreting or applying rules to new situations. They're obviously extending the legal system. Of course, their language might hide it, but as Hart said, it's inevitable. So although there is obviously this choice of within judicial judgment, and this is what Maine presented as an aspect of the evolution of law, whereas the realist presented it as the beginning of law. You have moral systems like what Maine called bodies of equity, which had like this moral character, but at the same time purported to be law and would slowly become so dominant within the perception of the people that would slowly override civil law and become part of it. And that's it, like customary. And of course, at the end, you have legislation, which international law already employs in this kind of like quasi legislation nature.
I actually agree with you that there seems to be no like overarching theory that we could use to deduct some conclusions about customary international law in the context of a greater scheme of what customary law is as such and how it impacts our understanding of law. And Yeah, you mentioned a couple of times already this evolutionary understanding of the law that is so characteristics of the Oxford jurisprudence circle. And it seems, as I understand it, that evolutionary understanding of the law kind of diminishes the importance of these formal sources that are so critically important for especially international legal positivists. And yeah, for that reason, I think many international legal positivists, also jurisprudential positivists, would be very much, you know, pushing back against this idea that there is something evolutionary about the law, because this historical understanding doesn't seem to tell us much about the nature of law, whereas you argue the opposite. So how would you respond to this argument?
The whole structure that Main's book called Age and Law has is about tracing two categories of societies. You have the progressive societies and you have the static societies. So what differentiates the two is exactly their perspective on formalism. So all societies at a certain point have a need to formalize law. At the domestic level, it's because you want to consolidate power, you want to limit what those who function under law can say they do in the name of law. Internationally, you have less of a need for it, but still the need of like having clarity, of knowing the certainty of what I need to follow. But once law gets formalized, gets written down, I mean, for Maine, law, the formalization of law appears with the appearance of language. When written language appears, the first thing that people want to write down are the most important rules, and that's when they create a concept for them. I mean, that's what the 12 table, the 12 tables of Rome were. So before you have like written language, there's not a point to gather these rules together. They're implicitly known within a society that it's so closely knitted together. So once they're written down, then you get them formalized, but then you get the big problem. The big problem is that society expands, evolves, needs change, and those rules stay static in the past. So the static societies are those that didn't find ways to update their formalized rules, and they perished. So Maine, as he traces it out, static societies are the rule, are like the norm. Mm. Very few societies were progressive societies, and that's why he focused so much on the Romans. And he traced out all the different tools that they used to keep updating their laws, these agencies of change. So there were the legal fictions, equity, and legislation. Of course, this brings us to this point here and now. And this doesn't bring out, this doesn't rule out the fact that there might have been more agencies of change that he didn't pick up on. But what his last book brings out is that it cannot be the last. Because his last book, which is more political, it's about the concept of democracy, and he brings out this concept of the irreconcilables. So he theorized that at a certain point, different political groups will rise up that will hold political views as strongly as groups held religious views, and that they would not be able to be reconciled. And that would bring a collapse to society if you didn't find a new way to update law. Because once you have these irreconcilable positions, it would be hard to legislate on specific things.
That's the book on popular government, right? I think.
Yes. So I think international law could be this new mode of change, because in many ways it's circumvents domestic debates and brings out this harmonization within rules without necessarily impinging too much, at least in my opinion, within the particularities that different cultures share. Although, of course, international law is still a developing legal system, so the choices that we make today will affect how it looks tomorrow. So this is also a principle to keep in mind, of preserving the different particularities within different cultures and legal systems, but still finding a way to making them coexist peacefully, or at least containing their disagreements within legal terms and within legal courts.
Nice. I think this gives a lot of food for thought for our listeners. And it brings us to the speed round questions. These are questions, short questions that we ask every guest. And the first one is, academically speaking, what's the force that drives you? What drives you to do what you do?
What I find interesting, if you look at participants within domestic legal systems or even internationally, is that while they coexist within one legal profession, they have all these different conceptions of law, all these underlining assumptions. And yeah, I think that it would be more useful for society if we started our conversations and our legal education from examining all the different conceptual views that exist, because inevitably each participant within the practice employs one, but doesn't realize how there are other equally valid ones and how others employ others. So I think starting the discussion from there would make it easier to reach acceptable answers. I think the debate as it is now is a little bit confused, and to be able to solve it, you would have to go back to the beginning. What I'm hoping that my work does.
Second question, what is something you struggle with?
Well, I struggle with the fact that generally lawyers and legal professionals are not really interested in these fundamental questions or these conceptual level discussions. You can bring them into the legal debate, but you always have to do it hidden through some practical question that needs answering. It's a challenge when you cannot address head on the thing that needs addressing, and you always have to find other matters to piggyback it through.
Lastly, but not least, obviously, what is a book or an article that you think everyone should read?
I mean, obviously, I think that everyone should get educated about the position that the Oxford Circle has developed and the reading of heart that comes out of it once you combine them. But at the same time, it's hard to suggest their books because although they have philosophical interests, they were not philosophers. So it's not as accessible as I would have liked. Yeah, hopefully I can bring out my thesis and maybe people will be interested to see this new perspective that at the very least they can disagree with.
So yeah. Everyone should read your book when it's out.
Well, just so they can be informed of this forgotten school of thought. Of course, again, in my thesis, I don't attack their legacy head on. I do it through a rereading of heart perspective. So that kind of changes how the storytelling goes. I have published a number of articles solely on their school of thought and utilizing some aspects of their legacies that heart left unutilized, in my opinion. So hopefully soon we'll have another school of thought to play with. Yeah. But that will be my advice, especially to new scholars, would be that there's a lot of people already dealing with the big school of thoughts, and it has been a little bit overdone and oversaid, and it would be more interesting if they spawned out to read books that no one else reads and no one else discusses and bring new perspectives into this debate.
Andreas Hadzegeorgiou, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And I'm looking forward to hearing the podcast, the episodes that you're bringing out, and all the future ones that you record.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Best of luck.